The Expert on News Radio 1240 and 107.5 FM WTAX. Brought to you by Memorial Health System. You have questions about your health, and Memorial Health System has the answers. Our phone lines are open at 753-1240. That's 753-1240. Now, ask the expert on News Radio 1240 and 107.5 FM, WTAX.
Welcome back to another episode of Ask the Expert. I'm your host, Ray Lytle, and it's so good to be here on this hot, it's a hot one today, on this very warm Tuesday afternoon. And this, we got a great topic this week and a couple of great experts. We're going to be talking about ovarian and uterine cancer, which when I tell you some of these statistics, and I'll have the doctors give some as well. When I tell you some of these statistics, you're going to be, it is such a, it's top five in a cause of death cancers, and we're going to talk about that more in a moment. First, let me introduce our experts to you. Dr. Nora Mixura is a gynecologic oncologist with Springfield Clinic, and Dr. Laurent Brard is associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology and chief of the division of gynecology oncology at SIU School of Medicine. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Ray. Appreciate it.
We are going to be discussing ovarian and uterine cancers. Everybody knows about, I've heard of ovarian cancer, but there's other types of things that we'll be talking about today. But let's start with this. I want to start with this before we get going, because I think it's really cool that Memorial's doing this. Memorial Medical Center is going to hold a free seminar on ovarian and other gynecologic cancers on September 26th. So I want to get this right out at the beginning. September 26th, starting at 6:30 p.m., they're going to have a two-hour program called It Can't Happen to Me, Ovarian, Cervical, and Uterine Cancers. Our experts will be part of this, and I'm telling you, it is this sounds like a really informative seminar, and we'll talk about it more as we go on. But I said earlier that ovarian cancer is one of the leading causes of cancer-related death among women. So let me start with ovarian cancer. What is ovarian cancer? I know it's a part of the body, but give me a general description of what ovarian cancer is.
So in general, ovarian cancer, simply put, are cancer cells that have arisen out of the ovaries. And they can oftentimes spread to other areas within the abdomen or pelvis, but it originated at the site, which would be the ovaries. The diagnosis can also include fallopian tube and cancers that arise from the lining of the abdomen called the peritoneum. And so we oftentimes will use the general term of ovarian cancer, but it tends to encompass cancers that may have arisen from the fallopian tube and the peritoneum as well. And this generally is done because they behave similarly. The prognosis is similar and the treatment is similar for these. There are several subtypes of ovarian cancer that exist. I think for the purposes of today's conversation, it would be best just to focus on the most common type, which would be epithelial ovarian cancers. And that's what you hear about most commonly in the news. And what most people are referring to when they mention ovarian cancer. But there are several other subtypes that do behave differently and do have different treatment patterns. And so that's just to keep that in mind for our discussion.
So ovarian cancer, it's more of a region than just one area. There are several different areas that can get it. Ovarian cancer is something that the statistics, they say it's the fifth leading cause of death for cancer death. For women, what is what's the amount of women that are affected by this? Do we have numbers on that?
We do. So just quickly getting back, one way to sort of really easily think about ovarian cancer is just to think of a hen egg.
Okay.
So you have the shell, which is sort of the epithelial lining of the ovary, so that's the equivalent. And then you have the yolk, and then you have the white. And so each layer can cause cancer. And as Dr. Mixura pointed out today, we're going to focus on that shell, sort of the outside of the ovary, so the epithelial lining. With respect to numbers, they tend to vary year by year, but in general, there's about 20 to 22,000 women who are diagnosed in the United States with ovarian cancer, and unfortunately, about 14 to 15,000 of those women will die per year.
Oh, my gosh.
Devastating disease.
Yeah. What was the over? What was the overall number again?
About 22,000 per year.
22,000
get diagnosed, and approximately 14,000 to 15,000 per year will die from this devastating disease.
That is, I mean, wow.
Yes, and because of that, we consider ovarian cancer to be one of the more deadly cancers.
It's the mortality rate is I mean, that's so high. Until you mentioned that, I had no idea it was.
It's the highest mortality rate of all female cancers.
And if you kind of want to make a comparison, for example, I like to kind of compare it to breast cancer, which people are very familiar with. If you look at the number of breast cancers that are diagnosed in a year, that's around 250,000. And deaths from breast cancer are more around 40,000. And so you can see the percentage there is much different. The mortality rate is much higher for ovarian.
What age groups are we looking at to – is this – every woman is susceptible to this? Are there age groups that are more prevalent than others? Or
well, age is definitely one of the biggest risk factors for ovarian cancer. The majority of these cancers are diagnosed in women who are older, so above the age of 60 to 65.
Wow.
Sort of the tipping point is really menopause. So usually the average age, as Dr. McDura said, is going to be in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Of course, you know, if we gave you an age range, unfortunately, even for epithelial ovarian cancers, which tend to occur in older patients, it could still happen much, much earlier in life.
So we see women, we see younger women that get this as well?
Unfortunately, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Rare, much more rare. As Dr. McDura pointed out, one of the risk factors is age. But Dr. McDura and I have had patients that are in their teens that can have epithelial ovarian cancer.
My God. In their teens,
mm-hmm.
So you mentioned menopause early. Now I don't. I'm not a female. I will never go through menopause. My wife will eventually go through it. And when that happens, you said it happens post menopause. Is when they have a higher risk? Did I hear that correctly? Or
so you did. The risk definitely increases with age, and you know, fifth, sixth, seventh decade. Or so the ages of greatest risk, and it does continue to increase with age.
And so they have to – I want to talk about the screenings, how you find out – like what – you know, when you mentioned breast cancer earlier. When women go in and get an exam, they go to the mammogram and they get that taken care of. What about – how do you screen for ovarian cancer? How often does it happen, and how do we go about doing that?
Well, unfortunately, we do not have a screening test that has been proven to work for ovarian cancer, and that is one of our biggest barriers in terms of successfully treating the disease. There have been many studies and a lot of research looking into ways in which we could screen for ovarian cancer, because we do know if we're able to diagnose ovarian cancer early, the prognosis is considerably better than advanced stage ovarian cancer. And unfortunately, the majority of ovarian cancers that are diagnosed are usually stage 3 to 4. But at this time, we don't have a great screening method. There is some data suggesting that does show some promise, but has not been, but does not have a lot of evidence backing it yet. So there is some hope that we may be able to, in the next few years, come up with a successful screening test. At this time, the best advice that we can give to patients is for them to continue to see either a gynecologist or a primary care physician for regular exams, and I'm referring to a pelvic exam. So I think at this point it's important to point out that Pap test screening does not screen for ovarian cancer. Pap tests screen for cervical cancer. And I think a lot of women fall into the caveat where they've had a normal Pap test and they feel reassured. And so they may be experiencing some symptoms or have some signs of ovarian cancer, and it may be the diagnosis may become delayed because of this reassurance that's false.
So we got a high mortality rate because it seems that we don't even know that cancer exists until such a late stage. By the time you even, Dr. McDura, you're as an oncologist, before you even start fighting it, you don't find out about it until it's stage, a later stage.
Well, that's one of the greatest difficulties with this cancer is that It can quickly move from stage one, which is sort of the early stage limited to the ovary, to stage three or four, which is spread into the abdomen. And really, that can vary from patient to patient, so that makes it even more difficult. Really, we know that mortality is greatly reduced when these cancers are diagnosed early. And just to give you an example, stage one patients have a 90% five-year survival rate. And when you look at advanced stage, that drops to 25%.
Wow.
So, and the difficult thing is, A, there's no great screening test, and B, we don't really know the timeline between the cancer being stage one to then moving to stage three or four. We don't know how quickly or how slowly that happens, but what we do know is that can vary greatly from patient to patient. So there's multiple challenges to screening test in this situation.
It blew me away. That we've never developed any kind of screening. It's something they're trying to do, I imagine. They're coming up with different ways. But I can't believe we've never developed that.
Well, it's true, and it is definitely an area that people are actively researching. But as Dr. Broad was pointing out, one of the issues with developing a screening test is understanding the natural history of the disease, and that's where we have trouble with ovarian cancer. We have looked at using ultrasounds, and there's a blood test for an ovarian cancer marker called the CA125 level, and they've looked at using these, and we haven't, even doing these frequently, say even 3 to 6 months, still we are missing the cancers, and we're still finding them at a later stage. And so part of the barrier is understanding the natural history and understanding how fast these develop. And additionally, ovarian cancer is so rare, it's hard to find a test that can perform under those circumstances. You have to have a screening test that really is an excellent test because the disease is so rare. And so those are two of our biggest obstacles in developing a screening method for ovarian cancer.
Yeah, when you said only 20 something thousand people get it in a country of, 320 million people, it is a rare cancer, but still, oh my goodness, it's a deadly cancer.
And the flip side is, when you do come up with a screening test, you have to be sure that you're actually discovering disease. So the one thing that we want to avoid, and studies were performed in the United States and internationally as well, remember that this is an intra-abdominal disease. So to discover it, you have to look inside someone's abdomen.
Right, yeah.
And so how many normal or non-diseased states do you want to find before you find one cancer is another challenge.
Is it polyps?
There has to be a good balance there.
Is it polyps, tumors? Is that what develops a growth in the ovary? Is that what we're talking about, or is it just the lining itself? Just I don't understand if there's polyps or if it just itself catches.
No, that's right. So the screening would be looking for evidence of an abnormality on the ovary.
Okay.
And so that could be in the form of a tumor or a mass or a growth on the ovary.
And forgive me, I'm ignorant on the whole on every. You don't use your ovaries past menopause at all. There's nothing. What purpose does it serve past a certain age? And I know I sound ignorant here, but I'm trying. I know during pregnancy there's a use, but what goes on at past a certain age?
Well, that's true. Once you enter into menopause, the ovaries are no longer functioning in their normal capacity, but it is believed that they still provide some hormonal benefit at a low level. And primarily, it's important for your bone health and for cardiovascular health. So we tend not to remove the ovaries automatically. We weigh the risk and benefit in any certain person. Certainly after menopause, the risk may be less than in a younger woman, but they still provide benefit.
So, when and some women go on medicines and stuff after menopause as well, right? Like I said, I don't pretend to understand all of menopause. I probably should. I think men should probably be less queasy about the whole thing and try to understand it. But I wish I did, especially for this conversation. But with women, some women get estrogen or different things like that. Is that somehow? Does that have anything to do with it at all, or have they found any studies? Is there any studies that discuss those things, or that have found any correlation? I'm just asking for my own.
So, in terms of hormone replacement therapy in menopausal women, there is some weak evidence suggesting that there may be an increased risk. But what they've seen is that once you stop using it, Within 1 to 2 years, your risk will fall back down to the general population. And overall, the risk appears to be fairly low. And so oftentimes that risk does not play into a woman's decision to use hormonal replacement therapy. But there is a small amount of evidence suggesting that there may be a slight increased risk.
I'm sure that this has nothing to do with Memorial, because Memorial obviously takes this cancer seriously and goes out of it. We treat it. We take care of it, Memorial, the best you can. But the medical community as a whole, are they less concerned? Or, how do I word this properly? Because it's such a small amount of people that get it. And I know some of you are saying, oh, my God, Ray, they said it's over 20,000 people. You know, it's almost 30,000 people, blah, blah. That's not small. But it is when you look at the population overall. Is it because it's such a small amount of people that get it that the medical community overall doesn't go out of their way to make this find screenings or anything like that? Or am I just barking up the wrong tree when I ask something like that?
No. I mean, I think the medical community is definitely engaged in trying to find solutions to this devastating disease. It's not really a matter of how small the disease is or how rare it is. The medical community is engaged. Of course, you're also talking to two very biased people who do this for a living. But there's been multinational, international studies that have looked at this. And you know, worldwide, it is obviously a bigger problem than it is in the United States. But it's not something that's being ignored at all.
Because you guys are, you deal with this all the time. So I wanted your opinion because of that, to make sure that we are, that the medical community is dealing with it, because, you know, even though it's not a giant number, it's still the fact that the scariest thing that you've said today is that they don't discover it till stage 3 or 4, or it's so advanced that that's why the mortality rate's so, I mean, when you look at the amount of people dying from it, that's so, it's astronomical. And, I know a lot of our listeners are in the age group you know, every day I'm getting closer to the age group. You know, you start to worry about these things, and for my mother and my wife, and for all the all the women in my life. You know, selfishly I start to worry about these things, and I hope that they're moving towards it. I want to take a break, and I want to come back. We'll talk about some of the treatments. What are the oncologists doing specifically to treat ovarian cancer? We'll get into that in just a moment. We are talking about ovarian and uterine cancer. It is an interesting topic today. I think we can all learn from it, and we'll give you a chance to learn more in just a moment. It's Ask the Expert on WTAX.
You're listening to...
All right, we are back. We're discussing ovarian and uterine cancers on today's Ask the Expert. I'm learning a lot. I hope that those of you at home or work, wherever you're listening, or even on the podcast, I hope that you are learning as well. When it comes to, we don't talk about ovarian or other gynecologic cancers very often. And I've got some experts today that are really filling us in. Dr. Nora Mazura is a gynecologic oncologist with Springfield Clinic. And Dr. Lauren Brard is Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Chief of the Division of Gynecology Oncology at SIU School of Medicine. I thank both of you for being on. I want to remind everybody, September 26th, Memorial Medical Center is holding a free seminar on ovarian and other gynecologic cancers that you should attend. It starts at 6:30 on September 26th, and it is in the Memorial Center for Learning and Innovation. So write that down, and just keep that in the back of your head, because that's coming up very soon, and we should try to get a big audience there to check that out. I want to talk about ovarian cancer treatments. We discussed ovarian cancer, and the rates are astounding. I thought it was... I was shocked to find out the amount of how they don't find this until stage 4, stage 3, and the amount of death is shocking. Dr. Mazura, you're an oncologist. When you how do we treat ovarian cancer? I mean, what is the
So the cornerstone for treatment for ovarian cancer, and this generally applies to all stages, involves surgery and chemotherapy. So really, it's a two-part treatment that patients need to go through.
I'm sorry. What was the first part?
Surgery.
Surgery.
Yes.
And then there's treatment after. Dr. Bard, what kind of the surgery is removal of everything, right? And then
so typically it depends on the amount of cancer that's present. If it's limited to the ovary, then what we perform surgically is called a staging procedure, where the typically the both ovaries are removed, as well as the uterus if it's present. And then we also remove lymph nodes in the pelvis and in the lower abdomen to make sure that the cancer hasn't spread. And then there's a fatty apron called the omentum that is also removed. And then random biopsies are also performed to make sure that there's been no spread into the upper abdomen. When there's a greater amount of tumor, or if there's tumor that's already spread to the abdomen, then the goal there is what we call cytoreductive surgery. And the goal is to remove all visible cancer. What we've learned from multiple national and international studies is that the more cancer is removed, the longer patients live. So there's a survival advantage. And actually, some of the newer data is showing that if before surgery we feel that that if the cancer is not completely removable, then we should start with chemotherapy first and then do surgery second. So there's been a slight reversal in our approach, and that seems to allow patients to have better outcomes, although that's still somewhat debated.
Is this and what kind of surgery is this? Laparoscopic, or do you cut into the abdomen? Is it? I mean, what the surgery is, and how long does the surgery last usually?
So, generally, for most patients, this will be an open incision. So, this will be kind of what we think of historically as typical open abdominal surgery. So, they usually end up having a good-sized midline vertical incision. And this is in patients that we already suspect stage 3 to 4 disease, which is, as we had mentioned earlier, the majority of our patients. The surgeries vary depending on the amount of disease, as Dr. Bard pointed out, in which organs may or may not be involved. And the goal is a cytoreductive procedure to try to remove all disease that's visible at the time of surgery.
So you have to be able, you have to see it when you open the patient up?
That's right. And the procedures generally take anywhere from 4 to 6 hours. They may take longer. Again, this depends on the spread of the tumor and which areas are involved within the abdomen. Most patients will have their ovaries removed, the uterus, the fatty tissue that Dr. Bard mentioned called the omentum. And then from there, it really just depends on what other areas and sites of disease are present. It could involve bowel resections. It could involve removal of the spleen. So these procedures can end up being fairly extensive, and patients do end up having a prolonged hospital course to recover from them. But even despite the longer surgery, the extensive surgery, and the risk of complications, we have found from studies that these patients do better and their survival is prolonged from these procedures.
You're taking a lot out in some cases. I mean, a lot of you're taking parts of the body out. You can see it taking 6 hours. That is, I want to take a break because we're up against news. I want to come back and I want to talk. You mentioned sometimes chemotherapy before or afterwards. I want to get into that. And then also, I want to jump over to your uterine cancer as well. I told you guys before we started, it's going to fly by, and it really is. We're over halfway done, and we'll get into uterine cancer next on Ask the Expert right here on WTAX. But first, we break for news.
You're listening to...
We are back on Ask the Expert, discussing ovarian and other gynecologic cancers. Uterine cancer is what we're going to discuss next. We were talking about treatment for ovarian cancer before we went to break, and was hearing about the surgery and of course chemotherapy. Dr. Broad, you mentioned that sometimes they'll give the chemotherapy first. Most times, is it chemotherapy after surgery?
Most times it is. Typically what happens is folks who are not healthy enough to have surgery should obviously start with chemotherapy. But also there is some newer data showing that if the GYN oncologist that's planning to operate on a patient feels that that patient will not be what we call optimally debulked, meaning that all the visible cancer will not be able to be removed successfully because of where it may be in the body. There are certain places that would put the patient's life at risk if we attempted to remove it. Then chemotherapy should start before surgery.
To try to shrink?
To shrink it, exactly. Okay. So then the surgery is is less complex, less involved. There's less risk of complications. The patient's hospital stay may be shorter. So there are some benefits to starting with chemotherapy, and some of our newer data is definitely pointing to that direction. And actually, there's some calls from our society saying that that should now be the standard of care in patients who really would not benefit from a big, long surgery and still leave cancer behind.
Well, we learned the surgery sometimes could last as long as 6 hours. Dr. Mazura, you said that there is a recovery. It's not like a simple knee surgery where you're up walking within a couple weeks. I mean, you've got this. There's a longer recovery time for this type of surgery, and chemotherapy, of course, will really take a lot out of people. But how long a recovery time are we talking overall?
Right. So these patients generally tend to be older patients. They tend to have other medical illnesses. Additionally, if they now are presenting with advanced stage ovarian cancer, they themselves may be malnourished or weakened from the presence of the cancer within their body. So all of these things in combination with a more extensive surgery does make recovery more challenging for them. Most patients are generally in the hospital around 7 to 10 days, and then we try to optimize them and help them recover from surgery within 6 weeks from their surgery in order to start chemotherapy within that time frame. A lot of times these patients need physical therapy services, rehab services to help them regain their strength from these surgeries. And so Memorial Health System has a lot of those services in place to also help us with our patients to help them recover.
Now, I do encourage everybody to read up on ovarian cancer. I mean, I've learned, just in discussion that we've had so far, I've learned, wow, I had no idea that the things I learned today, some of it was actually shocking. I had no idea in 2016 that there were these things, that such a high mortality rate for a cancer. I want to move on to uterine cancer next, though. Uterine cancer is it what it sounds like? Is this some cancer of the uterus, or uterine cancer is what?
So that's a great question. Just like the ovary, the uterus has different layers, and typically there's a muscle which can cause cancers, and those are typically sarcomas or carcinosarcomas. And then there's the lining, which is in a woman who's premenopausal, is the lining that will, for instance, harbor a fertilized egg. And that lining can become cancerous. And that particular cancer is actually the most common uterine cancer, and we name that cancer actually endometrial cancer, because the endometrium is the name of the lining inside the uterus. So that would be the most common cancer.
What age groups are, who is affected by this?
So again, for endometrial cancer, which is kind of what we're going to reference for this conversation, age is still a risk factor. But what we are seeing is that more women at a younger age are being diagnosed with this. And so this actually oftentimes is a younger population compared to the ovarian cancer population. So a majority of these cancers are diagnosed in women in their 40s or 50s.
So I want to bring this. You mentioned earlier that the pap smear, we always hear about the pap smear and all this stuff, that only is for cervical cancer. So how do we screen for uterine cancer? Is there a way to screen for uterine cancer?
So first, I just want to say that that's correct. Pap testing is strictly screening for cervical cancer. It's not an approved test to screen for endometrial cancer. And for uterine cancer, we don't, again, do routine screening for endometrial cancer. We base evaluations of women on an individual basis based off their risk factors and additional clinical factors that may or may not be present.
Are there symptoms?
So the most important thing, and this needs to be loud and clear to every woman out there, is bleeding after the age of menopause is never normal. Never normal. So what we call postmenopausal bleeding is never normal and should always be investigated. And that is one of the major risk factors for endometrial cancer.
Yeah, and I should say that is also probably why that we don't need necessarily a good screening test for endometrial cancer, because most women present with a symptom. Most women will present with postmenopausal bleeding, And the majority of these women are usually found at an earlier stage where they all do very well. And that's probably one of the reasons why no one has developed a screening test.
So this is so unlike ovarian cancer, this is discovered earlier than stage four a lot of times.
That's correct. However, unfortunately, it is not unusual for women to sort of postpone their health for all kinds of reasons. And if someone has postmenopausal bleeding and it's been going on for months, even years, then typically those cancers will be much more advanced than if they had presented earlier.
They'll go years before telling the doctor?
I have had patients tell me that they've had symptoms for greater than 2 years.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
That's why we're being so categorical here and so strong about the fact that postmenopausal bleeding, the minute it happens, needs to be investigated.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to say in terms of postmenopausal bleeding, that can be anything from just a small amount of spotting to a brownish discharge. So if you experience anything that could be considered that's new, it's a new symptom, I would definitely discuss it with your doctor to make sure it doesn't need to be evaluated.
So postmenopausal ages, it could be anywhere from starting at what?
The average age of menopause in our country is 51.
Okay, so, wow, really, it's that young?
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea. See, once again, I had no idea. Oh, so so you're talking women will get, and that's right, you know, for many women, that's, you've got kids, you've got a job, you've got a lot of stuff going on. I can understand it better now where there's so much going on in your life and your family's life that you, okay, well, there's a little bleeding. I'll get to it in a week. I'll get to it next month. I'll go to the doctor over this. You can actually see how life can get in the way and push that meeting or that appointment back. And when I think of it that way, it 2 years seems a little excessive, but I definitely can see someone waiting months.
No. Dr. Mercer is right. It's not, it's, I wouldn't say it's a freaking happening, but it does happen that patients will wait a couple of years.
But you're saying that, no, as soon as you notice this, we need to get checked. I mean, because is this because you find it earlier, the mortality rate not as high for uterine cancer? Unless, of course, you're waiting 2 years.
Yes, that's right. So in general, these patients do very well. Most patients are diagnosed at a stage one, so that's the earliest stage. And for these women, the prognosis is above 90%. It's 95 or greater.
And I want to... I'll take a break because we're running up against another break. But I do want to talk about treatment for uterine cancer as well. I want to talk about how you treat that, and we'll do that in just a moment. I want to make a mention of this because I want to bring it up every time or during every segment. Memorial Medical Center is hosting a free seminar on gynecologic cancers at 6:30 p.m. Monday, September 26th. At the Memorial Center for Learning and Innovation. This is going to be around a two-hour program called It Can't Happen to Me, Ovarian, Cervical, and Uterine Cancers. And it sounds really interesting. The stuff you're going to talk about is just things that we don't usually talk about, and they should be talked about. It's at the Memorial Center for Learning and Innovation at 228 West Miller Street. By the way, if you are interested in this, call 217-788-3333. That's 788-3333 or visit memorialmedical.com. That's memorialmedical.com. Or like I said, call 788-3333 and register for this free seminar, which sounds very interesting. I'll take a break. We'll come back with more. In fact, we're almost our last segment. We'll get into it in just a moment on Ask the Expert.
You're listening to Ask the
Expert. We are back. Ask the Expert. My experts, boy, you guys have taught me a lot today. Really, I mean, I did not know these things. Our experts, Dr. Nora Mazura, a gynecologic oncologist with Springfield Clinic, and Dr. Lauren Brard, associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology and chief of the division of gynecology oncology at SIU School of Medicine. We were talking about uterine cancers, and I wanted to get into the treatment about how it is treated. We talked about ovarian cancer earlier. Uterine cancer, what is it, surgery and chemo again, or what's the treatment for uterine cancer?
So for uterine cancer, the mainstay of treatment is usually just a surgical procedure. So most of these women are early stage disease, and surgery would consist of hysterectomy, so removal of the uterus and cervix, and oftentimes the ovaries and fallopian tubes will be removed as well. In comparison to ovarian cancer, the surgeries for uterine cancer tend to be minimally invasive, and that actually has become the standard of care. So these women should be considered for a minimally invasive procedure first. And at the time of surgery, additional lymph node staging may be performed depending on risk factors that are perceived at the time of surgery.
So the good thing, if there is a good thing about it, the good thing about uterine cancer is it seems like you discovered a lot earlier than ovarian cancers. And now we learned that just removal of just a hysterectomy will, most times that will be, so no chemotherapy sometimes or most of the time?
So oftentimes, especially if it's diagnosed early, surgery is curative. As Dr. Mirgzhiyeva was pointing out, there are some intraoperative risk factors that would push us to do more surgery, i.e. removing some of the lymph nodes, as we talked about for ovarian cancer, with the same concept that the cancer may have spread to the lymph nodes and we need that information. And if those lymph nodes were positive, then patients would actually need a combination of chemotherapy and radiation.
So you, when there's a cancer in the area, you always check the lymph nodes around it?
I wouldn't say always, but most times we do. It really depends on, again, the especially for endometrial cancer, we would look at some intraoperative risk factors and then decide if we need to remove lymph nodes or not. Because everything we do from a surgical standpoint has risks and benefits, and it has to always weigh in the sense that it benefits the patients and doesn't put them at excess risk.
And whenever I talk to one of the cancer doctors as an expert on the show, they do seem to mention there's always lymph node removal. Almost all the time, you guys always mention the lymph nodes in the area, and I was wondering how common that was because it does seem to come up a lot.
Well, the lymphatic system is actually considered an organ, believe it or not, and it is the way I like to explain it is really the filtration system for the bloodstream, and so this cancer can spread and basically be filtered by the lymph nodes and be there, just like a bacterial infection or a viral infection can be filtered and found in the lymph nodes. Same thing with cancer cells.
I'll have to do an episode on lymph nodes because I think a lot of us don't know. It sounds like the awareness for ovarian, especially ovarian, but uterine cancer as well, that the awareness, we should rise it up. More people should be aware of it. But it does sound like there's some advancements being made.
Well, the sad thing about endometrial cancer is that once it's found to be advanced, its mortality is no different than advanced ovarian cancer.
Oh, wow.
And frankly, there's actually less chemotherapeutic options for advanced endometrial cancer than there are for ovarian cancer. So one thing that we really, of course, we want to avoid any advanced cancers. We want to avoid cancers, period, but we definitely want to avoid any advanced cancers. And as I said, endometrial cancer in an advanced stage is actually worse than ovarian cancer.
Wow. So if you guys are, when you're saying, hey, postmenopausal spotting or bleeding, definitely this is something you need to go to the doctor
right away.
Yeah, absolutely.
No waiting 2 years.
Wow. That is something. I can't believe people are waiting that long. That is real. You guys, I've learned so much. Thank you so much. Our experts, Dr. Nora Mirgzhiyeva and Dr. Lauren Brard, you guys were fantastic in discussing this today, and we need to discuss it more. This has been Ask the Expert. Remember, September 26th, Memorial has a free seminar. 788-3333. Sign up today. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.
This has been Ask the Expert on News Radio 1240 and 107.5 FM WTAX, brought to you by Memorial Health System. For more information about Memorial Health System, visit choosememorial.org and join us every Tuesday at 3 for Ask the Expert on News Radio 1240 and 107.5 FM WTAX.